Chapter 36. You're not really going to die, sir, are you? Bargaining in which life vies with theatre and art with politics. As the meat operatives upstairs cut through the tape and slowly unwound the bandage with which they had attached the tape recorder to his chest, Carr tried to ingratiate himself by assuming their scornful air of efficiency and making fun of Blue. This may explain why he was not preoccupied with Blue's show of aggression downstairs. He sent the driver of the army truck back to the hotel with instructions to wait. Flanked by military guards, he walked from one end of the garrison to the other. The officers' quarters looked out over a large snow-covered courtyard where a number of boys were throwing snowballs among the poplar trees. Waiting there was a girl in a red and white wool coat that reminded Carr of the one he'd worn in the third year of primary school. A little farther away, two of her friends were making a snowman. The air was crystalline. The grueling storm was over and it was beginning to feel a little warmer. Back at the hotel, he went straight to see Ipek. She was in the kitchen dressed in a smock, the one all lycée girls in Turkey wore once upon a time, and over it an apron. As he gazed at her with happy eyes, he longed to throw his arms around her, but there were other people in the room, so he held himself back and instead told her of the morning's developments. Things were going well, he said, not just for them but also for Kadife. He said that while the newspaper had in fact been circulated without amendment, he was no longer worried about being shot. There was much more to say, but just then Zahide came into the kitchen to make a request on behalf of the two soldiers guarding the door. She asked Ipek to invite them inside and give them some tea. In the few moments left to them, Ipek arranged to continue their conversation upstairs. In his room, Carr hung up his coat and sat staring at the ceiling as he waited for Ipek. With so much to discuss, Carr knew she would be there soon, and without feigning reluctance. But it wasn't long before he fell prey to a dark pessimism. First, he imagined that Ipek had been delayed because she'd run into her father. Then he began to worry that because of the trouble, she didn't want to be with him. The old ache returned, spreading out from his stomach like a poison. If this was what others called love pangs, they held no promise of happiness. He was only too aware that as his love for Ipek deepened, these dark panics descended on him all the faster. But was he right to assume that these attacks, these fearsome fantasies of deception and heartbreak, had anything to do with what others called love? He seemed alone in describing the experience as misery and defeat, unable even to imagine bragging about it as everyone else bragged of love. He could only suppose that his own feelings were abnormal, and this is what bothered him most. Even in the torment of paranoid theories, Ipek was not coming. Ipek didn't really want to come. All three of them, Kadife, Turgut Bey, and Ipek, were having a secret meeting, discussing Carr as an enemy outsider and plotting to be rid of him. A part of him knew these fantasies to be pathological. So, for example, when his stomach began to ache at the terrible visions before his eyes of Ipek as another man's lover, another region of his brain would repeat assurances that these were but a symptom of his sickness. Sometimes, to relieve the pain and to erase the evil scenes intruding on his thoughts, in the worst one, Ipek refused even to see Carr, much less go to Frankfurt with him. He would, by force of sheer will, take refuge in reason, the one part of his mind that love had not thrown off balance. "Of course she loves me," he would tell himself. "If she didn't, why would she be looking so ecstatic?" With such thoughtful focus, his evil anxieties would float away. But before long, a new worry would inevitably come flying in to undo again his precarious inner peace. He heard footsteps in the corridor. It couldn't be Ipek, he told himself. It was someone else to tell him that Ipek wasn't coming. And so when he opened the door to find Ipek there, he was radiating hostility as well as joy. He had been waiting for 12 long minutes. His consolation was to see that Ipek had made herself up and was wearing lipstick. I've spoken to my father, and I've told him I'm going to Germany, she said. Carr was still so much enthralled to the dark images in his head that his first response was disappointment. He couldn't give Ipek his full attention. This failure to show any pleasure at her news planted some doubts in her own mind, or, more to the point, a disillusionment that proposed a way out. She still knew that Carr was madly in love, and already bound to her like a hapless 5-year-old who can't bear to be apart from his mother. She also knew that he wanted to take her to Germany, not merely to share his happy home in Frankfurt. His far greater hope was that, when they were far away from all these eyes in Kars, he would know for sure that he possessed her absolutely. Darling, is something bothering you? In later years, when racked with pangs of love, Carr would recall 1,000 times how softly and sweetly Ipek had asked this question. For now he replied by telling her about the terrible thoughts that had been running through his head. One by one he recounted them for her, the dreaded abandonment, the worst scenes of horror that had played before his eyes. If love pangs cause you such dread, I can't help thinking there was a woman earlier in your life who hurt you very badly. I've known a bit of suffering in my life, but already I'm terrified of how much you could hurt me.
I'm not going to hurt you at all, said Ipek. I'm in love with you. I'm going back to Germany with you. Everything will be fine.
She threw her arms around Carr, embracing him with all her strength, and they made love with such ease Carr could hardly believe it. Now he felt no urge to be rough with her. Instead, he took pleasure in the strong but tender embrace, glorying in the whiteness of her delicate skin. But they were both aware that their lovemaking was neither as deep nor as intense as the night before. Carr's mind was on his mediation plans. He believed that if, for once in his life, he could be happy, and if, by using his head, he could manage to get out of Kars, not just in one piece, but with his lover on his arm, that happiness might last forever. He had been thinking this for some time, as he smiled and gazed out the window, when to his great surprise, he realized another poem was beckoning. He wrote it down very fast, just as it came, as Ipek watched in loving admiration. He would later recite this poem, called Love, at 6 readings in Germany. Those who heard it told me that, although apparently concerned with the familiar tension between peace and isolation, or security and fear, and special relations with a woman, though only one listener thought to ask afterward who this woman might be, the poem, in fact, emanated from the darkest, most incomprehensible part of Carr's being. As for the notes Carr later made, these were mostly explicit remembrances of Ipek and how he missed her, and scattered remarks about how she dressed and moved. It may be because I'd read these notes so many times that Ipek made such a strong impression on me on our first meeting. Ipek dressed quickly and left. She had to say goodbye to her sister. But a moment later, Karife was at his door. Seeing her eyes larger than ever and her evident anxiety, Carr assured her she had nothing to fear and in particular that no one had laid a hand on Blue. He then told her he'd come to see what a very brave man Blue was by the difficulty he had had in persuading him to agree to the plan. Then, all at once, a lie he had sketched out in advance occurred to him in glorious detail. He began by saying that the hardest part had been convincing Blue that Kadife would agree to the plan. He said Blue had been worried that Kadife might be offended, and he couldn't agree before having talked it over with her. Here, Kadife raised an eyebrow, so Carr retreated a bit, giving his lie a more truthful ring by expressing doubt that Blue had spoken those words in absolute sincerity. Then, not merely to keep the lie afloat, but also to help Kadife save face, he added that Blue's reluctance, in other words, the respect he showed for a woman's feelings, was a positive thing, especially for him. It cheered Carr to be spinning lies for these luckless people who'd allowed themselves to be swept into the asinine political feuds of this stupid city, the city that had taught him so late in life that the only important thing was happiness. But a part of him knew he needed to spin them because Cardiffe was so much braver than he was, so much readier to make sacrifices. And as he sensed how much unhappiness lay before him, his mood darkened. That's why, before cutting his story short, he told one more white lie. That, just as he was leaving, Blue had asked him in a whisper to give Cardiffe his best. Carr then proceeded to set out the plan, and when he had finished, he asked her what she thought of it. "I'll bare my head, but I'll be the one to decide how," said Cardiffe. Carr tried to convince her that Blue didn't mind her wearing a wig or something along those lines, but he stopped when he saw he'd angered her. The plan now went like this. First, they were to release Blue. Blue was to go into hiding, somewhere he felt safe. Only then would Cardiffe bare her head, in a manner of her own choosing. Could Cardiffe write out the plan as she understood it on a sheet of paper and sign it at once? Carr handed her the statement Blue had given him, hoping she would use it as a model for her own. But seeing the emotion on Cardiffe's face at the mere sight of Blue's handwriting, Carr felt an unexpected wave of affection for her. As she read, Cardiffe did her best to keep Carr from looking on, too, and at one point she even sniffed the paper. Sensing some hesitation, Carr told her he would use the statement to persuade Sunayi and his associates that they should set Blue free. The army was probably angry with Cardiffe, and certainly the headscarf affair had not won her any friends in high circles, but everyone in Kars respected her courage and her honesty. Carr handed Cardiffe a fresh sheet of paper and watched as she threw herself into the assignment. He thought about the Cardiffe with whom he'd discussed astrological signs and walked down Butcher Street on the first evening of his visit. The Cardiffe, now sitting before him, looked much older. As he put her statement into his pocket, he said that, assuming Sunayi could be made to agree, their next task would be to find a haven for Blue after his release. Was Cardiffe prepared to help find Blue a hiding place? She gave her assent with a grave nod. "Don't worry," said Carr. "At the end of this, we'll all be happy. Doing the right thing doesn't always end in happiness," said Cardiffe. "The right thing is the thing that makes us happy," said Carr. He imagined a day not far off when Cardiffe would come to Frankfurt and see the happy life he and her big sister had made for themselves. Ipek would take Cardiffe to the Kaufhof and buy her a chic new raincoat. The three of them would go to the cinema together. Afterward, they would stop off at a restaurant on the Kaiserstrasse for beer and sausages. They put on their coats, and Cardiffe followed Carr downstairs to the army truck waiting in the courtyard. The two bodyguards took the back seat. Carr wondered whether he'd been right to worry about being attacked walking the streets alone. From the front seat of an army truck, the streets of Kars didn't look at all frightening. He watched women clutching string bags on their way to the market, children throwing snowballs, and elderly men and women clinging to one another to keep from slipping on the ice. And he imagined himself with Ipek at a cinema in Frankfurt, holding hands. Sunayi was with Colonel Osman Nuri Çolak, the coup's other mastermind. What Carr told them was coloured by the optimism engendered by his happy daydreams. He said that everything had been arranged. Cardiffe would take part in the play and bare her head at the appointed moment, and Blue was only too eager to allow this condition of his release. He sensed a quiet understanding between these two men, the sort one found only between two people who spent their youths reading the same books. In a careful but confident voice, Carr explained how delicate the mediation had been. "First I had to flatter Cardiffe, and then I had to flatter Blue," he said, presenting Sunayi with their statements. As Sunayi read them, Carr could sense that the actor had been drinking, though it wasn't even noon. Moving nearer to Sunayi's mouth for a moment, he was sure of it. This guy wants us to release him before Kadife goes on stage to bare her head, said Sunei. He has his eyes open, this one. He's no fool. And Kadife wants the same thing, said Ka. I really tried hard, but this was the best deal I could make.
We represent the state. Why should we believe either of them? Said Colonel Osman Nuri Cholak.
They don't trust the state any more than you trust them, said Ka. If we don't accept some mutual assurances, we won't get anywhere.
He could be hanged as an example to others, and then, when the authorities hear what a drunken actor and a broken-down colonel have done in the name of a military coup, they could use this to destroy us.
Hasn't any of this occurred to Blue? Asked the colonel.
He's very good at acting unafraid to die. I can't tell you what's really going on in his head, but he did imply that hanging him would make him a saint, an icon.
Okay, let's say we release Blue first, said Sunei. How can we be sure that Kadife will keep her word about appearing in the play?
If you bear in mind that Turgut Bey once endured a bitter trial and terrible suffering to preserve his honor, and that Kadife is this man's daughter, it should be clear that we can trust her to keep her word, far more than we can trust Blue. Still, if you told her now that Blue was certain to be released, it's possible that she wouldn't yet know her own mind as to appearing on stage this evening. She does have a temper, and she is given to snap decisions.
What do you suggest?
I know that you staged this coup not just for the sake of politics, but also as a thing of beauty and in the name of art, said Ka. Just a look at his career is to see that Sunei Bey's every political involvement has been for the sake of art. If what you want to do now is see this as an ordinary political matter, you won't want to set Blue free and put yourself in considerable danger. But at the same time, you know only too well that a play in which Kadife bears her head for all in Kars to see will be no mere artistic triumph. It will also have profound political consequences.
If she's really going to bear her head, we'll let Blue go, Osman Nuri Cholak decided. But we must make sure everyone in the city sees the play.
Sunei wrapped his arms around his old army comrade and kissed him. When the colonel had left the room, he took Ka's hand and led him deeper into the house.
I'd like to tell my wife all about this.
They approached an unfurnished room, still cold, despite an electric heater burning in the corner. And there was Funde Esser, posing dramatically as she read a script. She saw Sunei and Ka looking at her through the open doorway, but she continued reading without losing her composure. Dazzled by the dark rings of coal around her eyes, her thick rouged lips, the great breasts swelling out of her low-cut dress, and her exaggerated gestures, Ka found it impossible to grasp what she was saying.
Thomas Kidd's The Spanish Tragedy. The rebellious rape victim's tragic speech, Sunei said proudly, with some alterations inspired by Brecht's The Good Woman of Sichuan, though most of the changes are the fruits of my own imagination. When Funda delivers this speech tonight, Kadife will not yet have found the courage to bare her head, but she will be using the edge of her scarf to wipe the tears from her eyes.
If Kadife Hanum is ready, let's start rehearsals at once.
The desire in her voice not only made clear to Ka how much Funda Esser loved the theater, it also reminded him of the oft-repeated claim of those who'd wanted to deny Sunei the chance to play Ataturk, that Funda was a lesbian. Looking less the soldier of the revolution than the proud theater producer, Sunei was just explaining to his wife that Kadife had not yet resolved all the questions concerning her decision to accept the role when an orderly came to report they had just brought in Serdar Bey. Standing face to face with the owner of the Border City Gazette,
Carr felt himself succumbing to an impulse unknown to him since the time when he still lived in Turkey. For a moment, he was tempted to punch Serdar Bey in the face. But now, as they welcomed this man to a carefully laid meal with white cheese, soon he was sure to be accompanied by Raki. It was clear to Carr that such urges had no place at the table of revolutionary leaders, who sat down with an easy confidence known only to those for whom it has become second nature to decide other people's fates. As they ate and drank, they discussed the affairs of the world with merciless assurance. At Sunayi's request, Carr told Funda Esser what he'd just been saying about art and politics. When he saw how much these words excited her, the newspaper man said he wanted to write them down for use in a future article, but Sunayi roughly put him in his place. First, he had to correct the lies he'd printed about Carr in today's edition. And so it wasn't long before Serdar Bey had promised to print a new and very positive front-page article that would, he hoped, encourage the already forgetful readers of Kars to forget that they'd ever been encouraged to think ill of Carr. "And the headline must mention the play we're putting on this evening," said Funda Esser. Serdar Bey promised to publish the article they wanted. They could dictate every detail, even to the point size of the headlines. But as he wasn't very knowledgeable about classical or modern theatre, it might be better, he said, if Sunayi would describe this evening's play in his own words. That is to say, if Sunayi would write the article himself, just to ensure that tomorrow's front page was 100% accurate. He reminded everyone that for most of his working life he'd been writing about events before they happened. This, it could be said, was his fort. But there were still 4 hours to work with. They were operating on a special schedule in accordance with martial law, so the edition would not be put to bed until 4 that afternoon. "It won't take me much time to give you a rundown of the performance," said Sunayi. They hadn't been sitting at the table for long, but he'd already finished a glass of raki, Carr noticed. As Sunayi knocked back a second, Carr could see pain and passion flicker in his eyes. "Write this down, Mr. Journalist," Sunayi bellowed, glaring at Serdar Bey as if delivering a threat. "The headline is as follows: Death on Stage." He paused to think. "And then another headline right below in smaller print: Illustrious Actor Sunayi Zaim Shot Dead During Yesterday's Performance." He was speaking with an intensity Carr could not help but admire. He listened, unsmiling and utterly respectful, as Sunayi continued, speaking only when Serdar Bey needed help to make sense of his words. From time to time, Sunayi stopped to ponder what he'd said and clear his head with another raki, so it took him about an hour to complete the article. "I was to acquire the final version from Serdar Bey during my visit to Kars 4 years later. Death on Stage. Illustrious Actor Sunayi Zaim Shot Dead During Yesterday's Performance. Yesterday, while appearing in a historic play at the National Theatre, Kadife, the headscarf girl, shocked audiences, first by baring her head in a moment of enlightenment fervour, and then by pointing a weapon at Sunayi Zaim, the actor playing the villain, and firing. Her performance, broadcast live, has left the people of Kars trembling in horror. On Tuesday night, the Sunayi Zaim Theatre Company stunned the people of Kars with an evening of original revolutionary plays that gave way to a real-life revolution before their very eyes. Last night, during their second gala, the Sunayi Zaim players shocked us yet again. The vehicle on this occasion was an adaptation of a drama penned by Thomas Kidd, a wrongfully neglected 16th-century English playwright who nevertheless is said to have influenced the work of Shakespeare. Sunayi Zaim, who has spent the last 20 years touring the forgotten towns of Anatolia, pacing its empty stages and bringing culture to its tea-houses, brought his love of the theatre to a climax in the closing scene. In a moment of excitement induced by this daring modern drama that paid homage to both French Jacobin and English Jacobean drama, Cadife, the stubborn leader of the Headscarf Girls, brashly bared her head for all to see, and, as the people of Kars watched in amazement, she then produced a gun, the contents of which she proceeded to empty into Sunayi Zaim, the illustrious actor who is playing the villain and whose name, like Kids, has languished in the shadows for too long. This real-life drama reminded onlookers of the performance 2 days earlier, in which the bullets flying across the stage turned out to be real, and so it was in the horrified knowledge that these also were real bullets that the people of Kars watched Sunayi fall. The death of the great Turkish actor Sunayi Zaim was for the audience more shattering than life itself. Although the people of Kars were fully aware that the play was about a person liberating herself from tradition and religious oppression, they were still unable to accept that Sunayi Zaim was really dying. Even as bullets pierced his body and blood gushed from his wounds, but they had no trouble understanding the actor's last words, and never will they forget that he sacrificed his life for art. When Sunayi had made his last corrections, Serdar read out the final draft to the assembled guests. "If this meets with your approval, I shall print it word for word in tomorrow's edition," he said. "But in all my years of writing news before it's happened, this is the first time I'll be praying that an article doesn't come true. You're not really going to die, sir, are you? What I am trying to do is push the truths of art to their outer limits, to become one with myth," said Sunayi. "Anyway, once the snow melts tomorrow and the roads open again, my death will cease to be of the slightest importance." For a moment, Sunayi's eye caught Funda's. Seeing how deeply these two understood each other, Ka felt a pang of jealousy. Would he and Ipek ever learn to share their souls like this, or enjoy such deep happiness? "Mr. Newspaper Man, the time has come for you to leave, dear sir. Our work is done, so please prepare the presses," said Sunayi. "In view of the historical importance of this edition, I shall see to it that my orderly provides you with a plate of my photograph." As soon as Serdar Bey had left, Sunayi dropped the mocking tone that Kar had attributed to too much raki. "I accept Blue's and Cardiff's conditions," he said. He then turned to Funda Esser, whose eyebrows rose as he explained that Cardiff was willing to bear her head on stage, only if they would release Blue first. "Cardiff Hanum is a very brave woman. I am sure we'll come to an understanding once we start rehearsals," said Funda Esser. "You can go to her together," said Sunayi. "But first, Kadife must be convinced that Blue has been released, and that no one has followed him to his hiding place. This will take time." Thus, ignoring Funda Esser's desire to launch immediately into rehearsals with Kadife, Sunayi turned to Ka to discuss how best to organize Blue's release. "My sense from studying his notes of this meeting is that Ka was still taking Sunayi's promises at face value. In other words, Ka did not think Sunayi would have Blue followed to a hiding place after his release and recaptured once Kadife had bared her head on stage. It is likely that this concealed plan emerged slowly, and that its masterminds were in fact the secret police, still planting microphones everywhere and struggling to decipher the intelligence furnished by their double agents in the hopes of staying one step ahead of everyone. Perhaps they were even manipulating Colonel Osman Nuri Çolak to their own advantage. The secret police knew they were outnumbered. As long as Sunayi, the disgruntled colonel, and his small gang of like-minded officers were in control of the army, there was no chance of Meat taking charge of the revolution. But nevertheless, they had men everywhere doing everything in their power to keep Sunayi's artistic lunacies in check. Before the article he'd written out at the Raki table went to be typeset, Serdar Bey had used his walkie-talkie to read it out to his friends at the Kars branch of Meat, causing great consternation and not a little concern about Sunayi's mental health and stability. As for Sunayi's actual plan to release Blue, until the very last moment it was generally unknown how much Meat knew. Today I would say that these details have little bearing on the end of our story, so I shall not dwell overmuch on the minutiae of the plan to release Blue. Suffice it to say that Sunayi and Kar decided to leave the job to Fazl and Sunayi's Sivas-born orderly. Sunayi dispatched an army truck the moment he got Fazl's address from the secret police. 10 minutes later, they'd brought him in. This time there was fear in his face, and he no longer reminded Kar of Necip. It was quickly decided that he and the orderly should head for the army garrison in the city center. They immediately left the tailor shop by the back door, shaking off the detectives who'd been following them. For while the Meat people by now had grave doubts about Sunayi and were eager to keep him from doing any mischief, they were caught so unprepared by the speed of events that they still hadn't posted a guard at every exit. So the plan moved forward, and Sunayi's assurances that there would be no double cross were not contradicted. Blue was removed from his cell and put into an army truck, and the Sivas-born orderly drove straight to the iron bridge over the Kars River. With the truck parked on the near bank, Blue followed faithfully the instructions he'd been given. He made straight for a grocery store, its windows plastered with posters featuring special deals on garlic sausages. He then slipped out the back, where a horse-drawn carriage was waiting. Taking cover under the tarpaulin and making himself comfortable among the eye-gas canisters, he was whisked off to a safe house. Kar would hear of all this only after the fact. The sole person who knew where the horse-drawn carriage had taken Blue was Fazl. It was an hour and a half before this business was concluded. At about 3:30, as the oleander and chestnut trees were losing their shadows, disappearing like ghosts, giving way to the first shades of darkness to descend on the empty streets of Kars, Fazl came to tell Kadife that Blue had reached his hiding place. From the door leading from the courtyard to the kitchen, he stared at Kadife as if having just come in from outer space. But Kadife, just as she'd always failed to notice Necip, took no note of Fazl. Instead, she ran upstairs joyfully. Ipek was just leaving Kar's room where she'd been for over an hour. It had been an hour of undiluted bliss, and my dear friend's heart was soaring as never before at the prospect of his future happiness, as I shall undertake to explain in the opening pages of the next chapter.